of controlling velocity factor to length of cable that I really hit upon it. Because I was playing with this off and on given evenings. KD2FIU.
Yeah, you did hit a nice operation, a nice procedure. By your experimentation, you hit something that worked. If the transmission line, coaxial cable, was being used in the ideal way, where there is no common mode current flowing on the outside, and your main cable is 50 ohms, and the length of stubs that you're adding, I said stub, the extra length of tail, you call it, that you're adding, happened to be 50 ohm cable, and of different velocity factors, some of them are air-filled lines, some of them are foam-filled line, and so on. 50 ohm cable is 50 ohm cable. The velocity factor tells you how many wavelengths long is that particular 3 foot of cable, so to speak. But the velocity factor itself does not give impedance matching if it is a pure 50 ohm cable with no common mode current. Now, lots of guys have added extra lengths of cable in the shack to their transmission line, and they saw the standing wave ratio get better or worse. And they said, aha, there's some magic length of cable that'll correct the standing wave ratio. Their experiment led them to believe that that is the truth. Let me drop. And as I said earlier, if you happen to have common mode current flowing on the outside of the cable, which really means your transmission line is part of the tuning of the antenna, part of the length, the electrical length of the antenna, then yes, changing the length will change the standing wave ratio. But if there is no common mode current, changing the length of the cable, assuming the cable you're adding is lossless, will not change the standing wave ratio. It'll allow you to walk your dot around a circle on that Smith chart, yes, as a length of cable, but that doesn't change the standing wave ratio. That length of that circle on the Smith chart has got a constant radius to the center, a constant standing wave ratio, constant reflection coefficient, if you know what I mean. An antenna with standing wave ratio means a certain percentage of the power you send to the antenna is sent back down the cable as a reflection. And as long as the cable you're adding is 50 ohm cable added to a transmission line that's 50 ohms, that doesn't change the magnitude of the signal coming back down toward the transmitter, if you know what I mean. There's a lot of confusion on this one. KD2FIU, K2RIW, Grand George.
I'd like to know if you use something like an MFJ antenna analyzer.
KD2FIU. Dick, my issue was not trimming SWR. Trimming SWR was at the ends of the inverted V dipole, which I found it to be closer to a 430, not a 468 formula. Once I did get the trimming of the SWR down because of the capacitive environment that it was in, the feed point is a voltage balun and a current balun of 6 ferrites wrapped on the first edge of the cable at the feed point with a 213 66% velocity cable running 50 feet. What I did notice was 30 to 32 ohms with the SWR that I wanted, 1.2 to 1. I added this cable length that I'm recommending in formula with velocity change, this cable length having velocity change, and I saw 48. Meanwhile, I was experimenting with different lengths of different cable jumpers at the station end that didn't do it. KD2FIU. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, Rich wants to know, did you use an antenna analyzer? By the way, the 468 is for a dipole. It's for an antenna in free space. In your case, you had a 120-degree angle and inverted V inside of an attic. Well, that attic gives you a whole lot of local dielectric loading stuff. The dielectric constant of your shingles and rafters and the effects of the household wiring and plumbing and everything else, and and maybe even air conditioning duct that's up there. So the fact that your 468 worked out to be 420-something, part of that is the factor that that antenna was not in free space. That was in a much more complicated environment. Anybody have any further questions or comments on all of the above? K2LIW listening.
AC2GJE.
Okay, we got Roy and GJE in that order. Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that the 468 isn't an empirical calculation based on any of the laws of physics. It amounts to a bunch of guys for the ARRL handbook back in 1929, I think, trying out a whole bunch of different lengths and a whole bunch of different frequencies and ballparking it to that magical 468. So it's subject to modifications depending upon a whole bunch of variables.
Makes some sense. Mr. GJE, give us your full call and tell me your name again because I'm forgetful. GJE, go ahead. G2RAW.
Good evening, Dick. This is Ed, K2GJE. I have a question on the balance. He mentions using a voltage ballon and then putting some ferrite beads around the coax to perform a current battle ballon. Why two ballons, and what's the difference in them? Over.
I am guessing that what George did was to take ferrite toroids, slip them on the outside of his RG-213 to act as an RF choke right at the antenna feed point to stop any current from flowing down the outside of the cable. Now, when you do that, you could call that a ballon. In other words, it makes it a, what do you call it, voltage or current? I'm not quite sure which. But it stops any current from flowing down the outside. It takes your unbalanced coax cable. Unbalanced means under normal conditions, you've got zero signal on the outer shield of the cable and lots of signal on the center conductor of the cable. That's what they really mean by unbalanced. And by way of those ferrite beads at the last foot of the cable, acting as this RF choke, it stops any current from flowing down the outside of the cable. Therefore, your unbalanced cable acts in a balanced manner. And I guess you could call that a voltage ballon by doing that. Is that roughly what you did, George? KD2FIU, K2LIW?
KD2FIU. My initial testing of the inverted V in the attic under the rafters, and it is composite, there is no metal roofing. My initial was showing me that I really had a reactive problem with a voltage close to the feed point. So I put the voltage ballon in for a more equal voltage distribution on the two poles of the dipole. And from there, I threw the ferrites on to assure that I was choking at that point to not run down the 213 cable. KD2FIU.
Okay, so the ferrite was really one kind of a ballon or an RF choke. The other ballon, apparently you did put another ballon there. What brand name, what model number, what was the extra ballon at the end of the cable feeding your inverted V, George? Go ahead.
The voltage ballon I used was a simple radio waves, 20, 25 bucks, something like that. I did that because I saw an incredible reactive problem with the voltage coming back at me. And I did not want that. Once I put that in, I put the ferrites, the snap-on ferrites, just as a precaution for current return. But once I controlled the voltage on the inverted V under the rafters in the attic, I was able to then trim the length of the antenna to the SWR I wanted. I put the six ferrites on that drop point below the voltage ballon. And once I got to my station, I didn't like the impedance at the 32 ohms, and I worked on that tail. with a different velocity factor.
Your voltage balance, was that a 1-to-1 ratio, 50 ohm in, 50 ohm output, George?
K2RIW, KD2FIU, yes, 1-to-1 voltage balance.
K2GJE, K2RIW, you got it, Ed, for any further fills on this.
Okay, thank you. This is K2GJE. I've heard the terms used either way. People say I put a voltage balance, I put a current balance. I was quite curious because I rather to take 8 turns around the Clorox bottle. But anyway, that's the cheap way out. But evidently what I'm seem to learn is that the voltage balance is used to distribute the equal voltages evidently onto each side of an equal antenna. And when you put satellite beads around the coax, that's to keep the current from flowing down the outside of the coax, and they call that a current bound. If my explanations are correct, let me know. It's going to clear up a couple of things. As far as antenna tuners, years ago we always built them. And I originally used to operate in the Bronx from an apartment house with a long wire. And I'll tell you about the antenna tuner, that I built for that, over. Okay, I didn't want to time out the computer there. I took a coil that was like 10 turns in length on a 2-inch porcelain form, connected the transmitter to the first one turn, and then with a clip tapped up the turns and adjusted a capacitor from the antenna to ground to get the least amount of SWR. And I just had approximately maybe a quarter wave on 40 meters out the window, and I just fed one end over.
Yeah, that's pretty crafty as a tuning mechanism. If you took your coax cable and set it directly to a dipole, inverted V or any other kind of dipole, where the shield goes to one half of the dipole and the center conductor goes to the other half, in a pinch that works, but it's not exactly ideal because the coax cable wants to operate where there is zero voltage on the shield and all the voltage is on the center conductor. It's an unbalanced transmission line. And under normal circumstances, that shield goes to a connector that's bulk mounted, that's a bulkhead mount on a box, and therefore the shield of the cable and the shield of the box become 1-to-1, and the signal just flowing down the center of that. Well, a dipole really wants to be fed in a balanced manner. If you're feeding 100 volts to your dipole, on one half cycle, plus 50 volts is on the right side and minus 50 volts is on the left side. On the next half cycle, they reverse. So a dipole wants to be fed in a balanced manner. And as such, you just run your coax cable, shield and center conductor, directly to the dipole. Mother Nature tries to force that balance. You're pumping current into the right side with the center conductor, and so there's going to be the left-hand side of the dipole is acting like a counterpoise. A voltage drop will occur. That left half of the dipole is connected to the shield of the coax. Therefore, you will absolutely be launching current down the center, down the shield, outside of the shield of the coax transmission line. Let me drop. And as such, your shield becomes part of the dipole. The left-hand side of the dipole now has a different electrical length because it's connected to the shield. Okay. If you now have the right kind of a, let's call it an ideal matching transformer, a 1-to-1 transformer, there's a floating load at the end, and some of these balance you buy act that way. Although the transmission line up to that balun is unbalanced, after the balancing device, the balancing device is capable of putting 50 volts on the left side and negative and 50 volts positive on the right side on the first half cycle, and doing that without launching any current down the transmission line. A balun is capable of doing that. Putting extra ferrite beads on the transmission line is belt and suspenders to make sure that no current can flow down the line. Now, some of these Unadilla, I think is a brand name, among others, of balancing devices you can buy. Let me drop it. It looks like a fairly fat piece of PVC tubing with the UHF SO239 on the bottom and two screw eyes coming out of the top. If you actually look what's inside of that, there's really a bunch of ferrite toroids wrapped around the piece of RG213 transmission line that goes down the center. With enough ferrite toroids on the outside of your cable, that creates an RF choke. And that RF choke is so complete, it electronically acts like a one-to-one transformer. It won't allow current to flow down the outside of the transmission line. But still, the end of the transmission line that's right at the dipole is capable of launching thoroughly symmetric voltages, left side of dipole and right side of dipole, because of that choking action. So the fact that your transmission line is unbalanced coming into the bottom of this device, it acts like it's a thoroughly balanced, almost twin lead. It acts like a piece of 50-ohm twin lead out of the top of that balancing device. Those ferrites, at the proper operating frequency, can do that job for you. If you force the apparent inductance of the outside of the transmission line to be a big enough number, then you can't launch any substantial current into that shield. Let me drop. A poor man's balance does a pretty good job of doing that. You take the right number of turns of coax cable as a loop held together with tie wraps or with tape, and enough turns of the transmission line at the end of your transmission line that matches the antenna, that also is a kind of RF choke that will not allow current to flow down the outside of the cable. Again, it will, if properly done, it'll make your unbalanced transmission line at the end that's at the antenna act like twin lead. It'll make it act like 50-ohm twin lead, if you know what I mean. So there's a lot to be gained with using RF choking devices like ferrites to make sure that no current can flow down the outside of the transmission line. That it can stop RF from flowing around the shack and also make the antenna feeding a lot more pleasant. And properly done, these can be very broadband. To make one of these poor man's balance cover 80 through 10 meters is not out of the question. Anybody have any further questions or comments? Give me a call at K2RIW in the TechNet. And by the way, if you want to design that poor man's balance yourself, you go to the right chart in the first couple of chapters of the antenna engine, of the Radio Amateurs Handbook. There's a formula in there where you know the diameter of your turns and the number of turns and the spacing of the turns. You feed the numbers into that formula, it'll tell you how many microhenries is that RF choke. And you know that the reactance of an RF choke is 2 pi FL. F is frequency and L is inductance in henries. And you plug in those numbers and you'll know what inductive reactance you're going to get. In the case of a 50-ohm cable, if your poor man's RF choke, your number of turns, acts like, let me pick a number, 1,000-ohm inductance, which is some number of microhenries. The right number of turns will give you that number of microhenries at, for instance, 80 meters, which may be the lowest band you're going to use of that. Well, inductance doesn't matter. It's a function of frequency, but inductive reactance does. So you make that RF choke a large number of ohms of inductive reactance compared to the 50 ohms of the cable, and you'll be generating the design of a poor man's balance. So if you really want to design it, you want to know how many turns for your particular band, for your particular frequency of operation, that's one way of doing it. K2RIW listening.
W02Z, will they check in with a question?
O2Z, go right ahead.
My name is Ian. It's not related to the current topic, so if you want to put me at the end of the list.
Okay, Ian. We've got both Rich and you at the end of the list. N2EO, go right with your end of the list question. You got a Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. I'm glad you let me in again. Thank you. I don't know where I'm going, but I want to buy a lot of land. I have the money. I want to know something about rhombics. I never learned anything about them because I couldn't put one up before. What do you recommend? Do they only cover one band? I would like to go at least on 80 and 160.
A properly designed rhombic is a broadband antenna. You could design a rhombic to work from 80 through 10 meters inclusive. Properly designed, they give you quite a bit of gain in one direction. It's an arrangement. The feed point looks like a dipole, but the wire goes out there and makes a bend so that the top view, it looks like a diamond-shaped object. And there's almost always a 600-ohm loading resistor at the far end across the two pieces of wire as it comes back together. The rhombic is a so-called traveling wave antenna. A dipole is a standing wave antenna. The signal is bouncing back and forth on the dipole before it gets radiated. In the case of a rhombic, the signal flows down the rhombic once. Most of it gets radiated. What little bit is left over goes into that 600-ohm loading resistor at the end. So it becomes a unidirectional antenna, a highly directional antenna, feeding the signal primarily in one direction. As I said before, it's broadband. Let me drop. The first question somebody will ask is, what happens if I don't put in that 600-ohm loading resistor at the end? If I remove the resistor, whatever signal is left over that would have been absorbed by that resistor reflects back down the rhombic in the other direction, which means you're now going to be radiating a signal in the other direction. Your front-to-back ratio will degrade if you don't use that 600-ohm resistor. But with that loading resistor, it is a traveling wave antenna. Signal goes down there just once, gets terminated, what little bit is left over, and a well-designed rhombic is quite broadband and can give you a very desirable front-to-back ratio. If you've got some QRM area off the back of your antenna, and you got a desirable signal off the front of the antenna, that can be a pretty good antenna. The bad news about a rhombic is it takes a lot of real estate. In order to work properly, each of the four sides of that diamond-shaped chunk of wire is multiple wavelengths long in the ideal world. So it takes a lot of real estate. 10 acres of property could quite possibly be more than enough real estate to do that. And stringing it in the trees with a bow and arrow, that's another possibility. So if you like antenna experimenting, a rhombic has got certain desirable characteristics. There are people who have used stacked rhombics on 2 meters as a moon bounce antenna. And as long as you choose the right day of the month where the moon's in the right position in front of that antenna, people have done some very successful, the guys in Australia, I've done some very successful moon bounce on 2 meters with a rhombic. N2EO, K2RIW. By the way, there's a lot of stories. There's quite a few articles on the internet on rhombics. You've got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Very, very interesting. Now, where do I get a resistor? 600 ohms that will take my power. I have a kilowatt amplifier right here. You may remember it, the Henry 2K. There are 3500 Z's, puts out 1500 watts.
If you really design that rhombic correctly, with multiple wavelengths on each of the four sides, the majority of the signal gets radiated. You may be putting 1500 watts into the antenna. The amount of signal that gets down to that 600-ohm dummy load resistor might only be 50 watts, so to speak. Most people hand-wind that resistor, I think. I'm pretty sure you can buy it, but I think most people start off with some nichrome wire and wind their own resistor. And there's various ways you can wind it to lower the inductance of the resistor. So you probably think that resistor has to take the whole 1,500 watts. With a well-designed rhombic, 80% or 85%, I'm guessing 85% of the signal gets radiated before it gets down to that resistor. And even if you eliminated the resistor, the antenna would work like a charm, just that you would have a degraded front-to-back ratio. The signal that didn't get absorbed by the resistor would re-reflect down the antenna and give you some gain in the backward direction, if you know what I mean. N2EO, K2REW.
Okay, Dick. I thought, maybe I misunderstood, that when you disconnect the resistor, they become bi-directional. And I guess what would you recommend is a relay that I could run into the shack to connect and disconnect it. Maybe a transco.
Yeah, without the resistor, people may call it a bi-directional antenna. It really is going to have a hell of a lot more gain in the forward direction than the reverse direction, because a good fraction of that signal got radiated even before it got down to that resistor, if you know what I mean. And if you really want to get full performance out of the rhombic, by way of switching relays, you could decide to feed the north end or feed the south end and decide to radiate the signal toward the north or radiate the signal toward the south. So to reverse the direction of transmission and get full performance of a rhombic just means you, by way of relays, feed a signal into the other end of it and reverse which end has got the 600 ohm resistor, if you know what I mean. Who makes a relay capable of doing that? I don't know. But at HF frequencies, you could homebrew that relay. You could actually use relays that are intended for 60 cycle household current, and with the proper mounting procedure and the right kind of a shielded box, you'd get full performance out of that. I have taken crystal can type relays that are built into a metal can, and use them on 6 meters, and it worked like a charm as a TR relay. So with the right kind of a mounting procedure and the right kind of dressing of the cables going in and out of that relay, some relays that were never intended for RF service can do that job very well. N2EO, K2REW.
Okay, Dick. N2EO. Very interesting. I never studied rhombics because I never had the real estate. Now I will. Anyway, thank you, Dick. N2EO.
Okay, Ian, you're next. I think it's Whiskey Zero QZ. I'm not quite sure. I can't read my own writing. You've got it, Ian. K2RIW.
Good night, Dick. The call is WO2Z, and the name is Ian. And it may be a topic that you've covered before. I have a piece of vintage equipment, and it has a whole bunch of tantalum capacitors in there, and trying to do some work on there, but each time, you know, I turn it on for a few minutes, one of them ends up smoking. And they're used primarily on multiple boards for decoupling the DC lines. And I was just wondering, if one were to replace them, would you recommend replacing them with the same type of capacitor, or would you replace them with something else?
Okay, I missed a couple of words. I think you're discussing a piece of test equipment. I think it's got capacitors that are smoking on you. I don't know what kind of piece of test equipment it is. I don't know what it's doing. And you're trying to fix smoking capacitors, if I understand correctly. So run that by again, Ian. WO2Z, K2RIW.
What it has to do, if it's an old piece of equipment, is bring it up very, very slowly with a variac.
Yeah, some of the transmitters we've used in the past used voltage doubling type power supply networks consisting of electrolytic capacitors. And electrolytic capacitors have got a nasty habit of drying out and going very low in capacitance. And when you replace them, it's a big deal. By that I mean slowly. In some cases, you can bring the capacitors back to life by slowly bringing up the voltage. But After a certain aging, after a certain amount of drying out of electrolytic capacitors, that may not work, and you may have to replace them. And some of the capacitors you can buy these days have got the same number of microfarads, but they're intended for AC motor service. Mallory, for instance, makes some very high-quality capacitors. Replacing them, even though they might be physically a little bit different and have, give you a mounting problem, that can give you a much more reliable power supply. So maybe that's what you're discussing, the Voltus Doubler type power supply. WO2Z, K2RW, you've got Ian.
Is this any better?
You're sounding good right now, Ian, go ahead.
It's an old piece of, it's an old transceiver, probably 80s vintage, and it's the tantalum capacitors that they use in for decoupling the various boards on the DC lines, and they keep failing on me, so I'm just wondering, one, if you replace them, would you use the same type of capacitor, tantalums, or would you use something else?
Yeah, in the 80s, even quality brand names like Hewlett-Packard had a whole lot of these 35-volt, a couple of microfarad tantalum capacitors used for coupling networks and power supplies and whatever, and the tantalums had a nasty habit of turning into short circuits. And so I'd like to believe a modern-day tantalum doesn't have that problem anymore. I'd like to believe they've solved that problem. And so I think you could put tantalum capacitors in there if they're of modern design. To take a tantalum capacitor manufactured in the 80s might not be a good solution because the problem can come back again. An awful lot of people who are very conservative will take all of those tantalum capacitors in their piece of Hewlett-Packard equipment and replace them with some other kind of capacitor nowadays. A lot of people have done that. So tantalum capacitors are nice and compact, but the ones that were manufactured in the late 80s, early 90s, had this nasty failure mechanism that didn't show up for a number of years downrange. As I said before, even quality brand names like Hewlett-Packard were using those. Over to you, Ian, K2RIW.
And it is it's a piece of equipment made by Harris Radio for military use, but so if you were replacing it, then what would you, use electrolytic? Would you use, what would you use in place of that if you had one or two choices?
The first thing I would worry about is the number of microfarads, and the second thing I'd worry about is the working voltage. If I could buy capacitors of the right number of microfarads and the right working voltage, that does solve the problem, even though it's a very different kind of capacitor. And so lots of brands of capacitors will do the job. The old-fashioned paper-type capacitors have a nasty habit of drying out. I'd be reluctant to use those. So I wonder if anybody on frequency has a recommendation for coupling and bypass capacitors that are being used on a 1980s vintage radio. What brand of capacitors, what kind of capacitors would you use today? Anybody with any opinions? Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW and the TechNet.
As far as brand, what do you think of Mallory?
Mallory makes some quality capacitors. So I like Mallory. And I wish I could think of some other brand names that I like. So voltage first, microfarads first, voltage rating second, and then a brand of capacitor that's not going to be drying out on you. Many of the electrolytic kind of capacitors, depending on the way they're packaged, have got a nasty habit of drying out and drastically decreasing in capacitance. They may be a new old stock sitting on the shelf, never used, and they might already be dried out, if you know what I mean. So you got to be a little bit careful and what capacitors you choose that don't have the drying out problem, or in the case of tantalums, of the vintage that has the built-in shorting problem. K2RIW listening for anybody else with some comments.
Dick, just real quick, the working voltage is three voltage lines, a 5 volts plus, 15 volts plus, and a 15 volts negative. So those are the three voltage lines that they'd be working at.
And voltages that low, the most popular capacitors in the past that did that were tantalum-type capacitors. There's a zillion kinds of tantalum capacitors, sometimes a very good brand names, that have working voltages of 10, 15, 30, and so on, with a nice compact size and the right number of microfarads. This shorting problem of tantalums, I'm not quite sure what the right solution to that is. And there are very few other capacitors, other than tantalums, that have working voltages in that region and a reasonable number of microfarads in a reasonable size package. You're probably forced to use tantalum again. Let's hope that you're using tantalums of a better design and a more modern vintage, so you won't get into this problem again. Over to you, ANK2RIW.
Okay, Dick. I'll probably do that, and I probably just ordered them from Mauser, and I'm sure they're not going to be sitting on the shelf any extended period of time when it comes to that. Matter of fact, well, that supplier. The radio did last, I'd say it's the 80s vintage, so it's 30 years since, you know, it was manufactured, so I would think another 30 years I wouldn't really care if they started shorting out again, so. Okay, so I'll look into maybe ordering some more tantalums and taking my time going through each one.
FIU input.
George, recognize. After you do the repair, Ian, come back and let us know how it all worked out. Go ahead, George.
I have not done any of these blanket repairs. I don't recommend a complete repair job, as some people say that when you have one of these vintage radios, to get the entire replacement capacitive kit. Whatever brand or whatever material that you're recommending here, my suggestion is start with learning the radio and learning how to troubleshoot each problem. Because I know some people who have taken a blanket capacitive repair kit, changed 10, 20, 30 electrolytic capacitors and had 10, 20, or 30 problems they had to troubleshoot. KD2FIU. Do it one problem at a time.
Okay, that's one solution. In the case of tantalum capacitors, they're extremely polarization sensitive. You put a tantalum capacitor in there, it's got a positive lead and a negative lead. Quite often the outer package is the negative lead and the center conductor is the positive lead, quite often. And you put a tantalum capacitor into a circuit in the reverse polarity, oh boy, you create a whole lot of troubles in a hurry. So you got to be very careful with that particular parameter. So, good luck with that project, Ian, and let us know how that works out, whether it's good or bad, if you know what I mean. I think it's time we go over to the science and physics report. And I'm looking at the list of possible subjects there. You've got a beautiful long list here, Roy. AC2GS with a science and physics report number 33, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS. And once again, if you want to contact me, if you have any questions, or if you have any topics, or if you want to correct me, feel free. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. And I got a nice long list, and most likely I won't get to it entirely, and that's fine. It saves me some work next week, right? I'm going to go down the list and talk about individual topics, and if anyone wants to stop me or interject any opinions or questions, feel free. Let me drop. Okay, one that comes straight out of Oak Ridge National Labs is a new supercomputer. You may not have realized, but we lost our lead in supercomputers recently. China had a Sunway Tehu Light, which had a capacity of what's called 93 petaflops. We don't like to be second best, so they manufactured a lovely little new supercomputer down there at Elk Ridge National Labs. It's called Summit. It has 200 petaflops. That's 200 calculations per second. Much faster than Chinese 93 petaflops, and 7 times faster than our previous super-duper computer, the Titan, which was the holder of the title back in some years ago in Oak Ridge Lab. So once again, we are the number one guys with supercomputers until the Chinese build a bigger one.
WHSCDL for Lloyd.
And I think PETA is 10 to the 15, 300 times 10 to the 15. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. Well, you once asked a question to me regarding your radio unkeying. I noticed that your radio is unkeying momentarily and then rekeying again. Are you doing that yourself, or is that the radio doing it on its own?
As far as I'm aware, this is happening with the radio. I'm not doing any kind of strange things. And when we talked last about this, I wondered why, when I do my TechNet on KC2RC and I record, I don't have these little gaps. So I'm a little confused why one repeater has gaps and the other repeater doesn't have gaps.
I heard it twice that time. I think Dick could confirm what he heard, too, if he was listening.
Yes, this has been going on for quite a number of weeks. If you listen to his input frequency, the dropout is not there. There's something to do with the repeater and its voting system that's doing it. We've speculated that it's not the right level of PL tone or audio overload. We had all kinds of speculations. And
the DCL can be unlocked and you wouldn't hear it.
Okay. So are you saying, Eric, that you believe it's his radio doing it? Eric, go ahead.
Well, that's what I'm hearing Andy say.
Yeah, but Andy may not have been listening to Roy's signal directly on the input. Is that true, Andy? Go ahead, Andy.
First, to clarify, I didn't say that it was his radio. I asked a question to Roy. Is he unkeying by deliberately? Is Roy doing this, or is the radio doing it itself? That was the question that I asked. And Roy responded by saying, no, he's not doing anything, so it's happening on its own. So it's either his radio doing it or the repeater system, one or the other.
When you listen to his signal directly from his radio, you will not hear that dropout, but you do hear it through the repeater. So there's some kind of an incompatibility with his location, his radio, the voting system, and whatever. There's some kind of an incompatibility there that we think is doing it. And Eric and I and Roy have had all kinds of theories, and I don't think we've gotten to the bottom of it yet. Let's see if Eric's got any further words on the subject. You got it, Eric, K2RIW.
You know, I don't really have any suggestions other than I'd like to see what he's putting out on a deviation meter, because the filters in the repeater are pretty sharp, and they don't like things being too fat.
There are times, though, when it does a dropout during a pause in his audio, so the audio being over-deviated is less likely to be it, in my opinion. You got it, Roy. K2RIW.
Thank you for letting me jump in. I didn't mean to interrupt your net.
Jump in anytime you want to. We're not that persnickety here.
I got one question for Andy, if you don't mind. Andy, keep an eye on the output of the repeater. Somebody sent an email saying that as the TechNet goes on, he's far away and the signal gets weaker.
Doesn't show up on my yes meter. How about yours, Andy?
Well, I'm in the car and it's full scale here, full quieting. It sounds good. Is he talking about this repeater or the East repeater? Did he clarify that?
Well, the email, I think, well, let me look at it again. I think he's referring to this one.
This is in Danbury, which would mean he would be getting it from this repeater, not Seldon.
Well, I'll watch it, but it's, I've been listening to the net, but on a handheld, not upstairs where my equipment is. Okay. All right, well, I'll keep an eye on it. Let me give it back to Roy, because I don't mean to hold Roy up, but I know he's got a lot to say, so thank you.
He refers to the 85 repeater, so listen there if you can.
I will.
There have been people in specific directions which periodically hear a fade from the repeater, and when you really discuss what's going on, in some cases, it's multipath. If there's two separate paths that get the signal to your particular receiving antenna, and those two signals are almost out of phase with each other, and with very minor changes in weather, moisture, whatever, one signal gets a little stronger, the other gets a little weaker, and you can get a cancellation. So in certain directions, people will hear periodically hear some funny effects like that. AC2GS, K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
Okay, Doc, I'm sure we'll figure it out one of these days. Getting back to Summit, the new supercomputer, if anyone likes statistics and specifications, it's made out of 4,608 different servers. It takes up the size of two tennis courts. It has 9,022 core IBM processors and 27,000 NVIDIA Tesla GPUs. Those are the things some other people use for their graphic processor units. A cooling system takes 4,000 gallons of water a minute. The Summit uses enough power to run 8,100 homes. So don't think that you're going to buy a supercomputer in the near future. So that's our lovely little Summit. China had the record for 5 years. Let's see how long we keep it here.
Where is that behemoth located, Roy?
I believe the Department of Energy built it at the Oak Ridge National Lab.
Yeah, they've got the local power to do that.
And they're going to use it for a lot of very esoteric stuff. These are the computers that you run simulated models where the variables are incredibly large. You know, that they'll model the universe and try and figure things out with these types of computers. So it's going to be fascinating what they pop out with.
And who was the previous KC2SHO?
Up until now, let me drop for a sec. Up until now, China had a computer. It was called, apparently, the Sunway Tehu Light. And that was for 5 years. Before that, the guys at Oak Ridge had the prize as well for a computer that was called Titan.
Any idea how many petabytes each one of those was running up, Roy?
Yeah, the Chinese supercomputer only ran 93 petaflops versus Summit's new 200 petaflops. And the old Titan was about one-seventh the power of the new Summit.
WS2S.
Yes, Paul.
Last one I remember, I think it came from the same place, Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, was the Sequoia. And I know that was the fastest one. So apparently the Chinese must have come up with the other one, and then this other one that you're talking about. So I guess I'm way back. I'm probably around 2010 or something.
Yeah, it's an expensive contest, and everyone's looking to be the guy who's at the top of the mountain. So I don't know where Sequoia fits in. It might have been right before the Titan, which was right before the Sunway, which was right before Summit. I think it's a nice name for a supercomputer for a bunch of people who want to be king of the mountain, calling it Summit.
Uh, I'm glad we're on top of the mountain. Very good. That's good to hear.
Do you have a guess, Roy, as to a 200 petaflop, petaflop computer? Would the programming of that computer, to use all of its capability, be conventional serial programming, or would the programming be written in a more parallel manner? In other words, separate subroutines running in parallel simultaneously maybe would be the way to get the most performance out of that machine. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, they're running that parallel. I think that's its entire reason for being is to crunch numbers much, much faster simultaneously than any serial designed processor can possibly handle. So parallel is the beginning, end, and the middle for something like this. I mean, they're doing things that in minutes that would probably take conventional computers a few lifetimes to process. One source says that 1 hour of Summit processing should take about a desktop computer 30 years to crack. So we're talking about heavy-duty computations, and you don't do that serially. You got to do it parallel.
A few bitcoins that way.
Sure, some smart aleck there has thought of kind of sneaking in one night and turning it over to getting Bitcoin generated into it. It's only a matter of time when some smart person's gonna pull that scam. In the end, it's all about blockchain. So let me go sideways to computers, because computers have been very popular in the news. There is a convention called Computex that's held in Taiwan that Intel and AMD and a lot of accessory makers showed up for. And the CPU companies have shown their own little prize packages to the world. AMD, you know, for you people out there who wonder why you need four cores when one core should suffice, AMD announced a 32-core central processing unit, and that's with hyper-threading, so it's effectively 64 cores. 32 are hardware, 32 are virtual. And Intel, just to kind of remind people that they're still around, announced a 28-core chip that they clocked at 5 gigahertz. Now, eventually people figured out that that was sort of a scam because there was an incredibly powerful cooler hidden off stage for them to be able to do that, because it natively works at something like 2.7 to 3 gigahertz. But that's something to look forward to and salivate for in the future. A 32-core central processing unit. Just think how many word processor documents you can play with it at the same time. Another subject that showed up in the news is that in the British Medical Journal did a interesting statistical analysis of people who are nearsighted and found that it correlates a great deal with higher education. When they looked at people who had college degrees and such, they found a considerably higher number of nearsighted people. And not only were there more of them, but they were even more nearsighted, needing at least one extra diopter of optical correction. They don't exactly know why that's the case. They did some correlation to see it was genetics, and they don't think the genetics, if there is such, that leads to higher education, had any correlation to it. But they're suggesting that little ones be shown the outside in regular sunlight instead of illumination from lamps, and not to strain their eyes when they're very little. Give them a couple of years for their eyeballs to settle. So, myopia is very, very common. Let me drop. They estimate that nearly 5 billion people worldwide, or 50% of the population, will have myopia by 2050, while they say 1 billion will have severe myopia. So everyone's going to need glasses, I guess, or they're going to need that expensive laser surgery. Next on my little list is, I don't know if you guys have been following the news in Cuba, but there was this strange thing going on in Cuba that the embassy, the diplomats who were stationed down there were suffering all kinds of nausea and vertigo and sleep disturbances and all kinds of things. And, you know, they were starting to feel that maybe the Cubans were pointing a death ray at them or something. Ultimately, they didn't prove anything, but the suspicion is that they're using some kind of method of listening into their communications that leaves a residual sonic signature that our human body really doesn't like. Well, it popped up in China, apparently, so maybe we should ask the Chinese if they sold some technology to the Cubans. Chinese diplomats from America and China are experiencing very similar symptoms of nausea and dizziness and very strange things, hearing clicks and odd noises in relatively silent environments. So maybe we're all being zapped by sound waves. AC2GS, on to the next subject. They've been doing some experiments with honeybees for some reason, and they wanted to know if honeybees understood the concept of zero. Now, if you know your math, you realize that zero is a relatively recent invention of most people, especially Europeans, only about 800-900 years. Prior to that, it was taken from Arab scholars who stole it or borrowed it from Indian scholars. So the zero was used much earlier in India. Then it was caught on in the Muslim world, and then the Europeans finally had it. So people wanted to test, for some strange reason, if bees could be tested to see if they understand the concept of zero. Let me drop. So what they apparently did is they trained bees, and I don't know if you can get paid for that, but I guess you can, to go to cards that have a small number of objects on it for a reward. And, you know, they'd show them four spots, and then the bees could land either on a card with five spots or two spots, and they kept on doing it until they felt that bees could figure out the difference between more of something and less than something. And then they decided to test the bees by giving them an empty card and seeing if they would register as less. And they did. So there are some guys out there who think that bees understand the concept of zero. There are other people who think that they just got lucky and it has nothing to do with anything. But in case anyone asks you if it's possible for honeybees to understand what a zero means, I guess the answer is maybe. Okay, here's another one for you guys. Everyone knows about cells. Everyone knows about viruses. I don't know if everyone knows about prions. Prions are a very weird thing. They are the carrier of disease, and yet they're not quite alive by just about any definition you can imagine. You know, viruses have that problem as well. Viruses by themselves can't really do most of the things that we call life. They have to shanghai another living cell to reproduce and to produce proteins, code it, and for continued existence. So they're kind of stretching the idea of life as it is. Prions really stretch it, break it, rip it up, throw it in the garbage, and burn it. Let me drop. An example of a prion disease is something called mad cow disease, which I'm sure a lot of you have heard. There is a human version of that called Creutzfeldt-Jakob syndrome disease, and it was first found among, unfortunately, cannibals who ate contaminated brains of people who had spontaneously developed this. What, you ask, is a prion? Well, unfortunately, it's kind of simple but strange. It's a misfolded protein. There are proteins that line the outer cell membranes in our brains and nerve cells, And this is a case of it being folded incorrectly that seems to propagate along. Throw a couple of these fragments of proteins on the brain, give it a couple